Okay, good evening, everybody. Good evening. I want to thank Fred and Donnie for opening up their home. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. I think I even see some refreshments for afterwards. And I want to thank Alana Weisbaum for organizing. Is Alana here? Yes. Thank you for organizing. I'm not exactly sure what we're going to be talking about tonight. I received a list of questions, so I thought we could use the questions. Yeah, random people submitted to you. So we could use the questions as kind of a launching pad or platform. And I also thought it'd be worthwhile to divide between the kosher kitchen and the Shabbos kitchen. So maybe tonight we'll do the kosher kitchen, issues of kashrus in the kitchen. And next time we'll get into the Shabbos kitchen, Shabbos and children, Shabbos kitchen, and so on. Because they overlap, but obviously they're two distinct topics. So if we're going to talk about the kosher kitchen tonight, before we get into the details and the minutia, I think it'd really be worthwhile to spend just 2 minutes on kind of the deeper meaning, the purpose, what kashrus is all about. And the reason I want to do that is because I think that when you get into the details and the minutia, it can be a turnoff, right? If you're here tonight, you not only want to get out of your house, hopefully you also have a level of commitment to kashrus. You want to do things right, you want to get it right. Maybe for some people here you know it better than I do, but you nevertheless want to review. Others learning for one of the first times. Others it's a refresher. Haven't sat in something like this in a long time. But you obviously have a level of a commitment. But we get into this conversation and we lose the forest for the trees. The sponge and the onion and the knife and the dishwasher and the sink and the splashing and that. And we sound like a bunch of obsessive compulsive disorder. You know, we can really sound like people who've lost the forest for the trees. So it's really important to remind ourselves what kashrus is all about. Why are we in this? It's not some random obsession. It's not because we have some mental health disorder that expresses itself through kashrus, although that can be a real issue. It's something, in all seriousness, it is something to be aware of, the difference between legitimate questions and the boundary between where it gets to an unhealthy obsession. And a person has to be very careful regulating themselves and keeping their eye out for others. But the general idea of kashrus, the Torah in two places tells us the laws of kashrus. It does so after the war with Midian in Parshas Matos Masai. It tells us when we conquered Midian and we acquired their kalim, their utensils, how we go about kashering their utensils. And it also tells us when it comes to the different animals in two places, which animals qualify as kosher, what are the criteria. Of course, for animals, they have to chew their cud and have split hooves. For fish, they have to have fins and scales. For fowl, there has to be a mesorah, there has to be a tradition. It's interesting. For birds, there are no signs or symbols. For birds, we have a tradition, which leads to a question. It's safe to tell you now, because it's a week after. Your leftovers, what's tonight? Monday night? Your leftovers are still, maybe you have one night left of them. But turkey. Turkey is a New World bird. And because of that, the question is, does it have a mesorah? Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky did not eat turkey. Rav Shechter, Mahavda Mechaim Mechaim, does not eat turkey. There are many who don't eat turkey because it's a New World bird. They say there's no mesorah. You could breathe easy. Empire, OU, whatever brand you got, there are kosher turkeys because we say turkey parallels other fowl that we do have the mesorah going back, so we eat turkey. So there are different criteria to determine whether different of the animals are kosher. We also have the Torah telling us basar b'chalav is prohibited. But what's the deeper meaning? The mefarshim, the commentators all get into this discussion. Some say it's an issue of health. Some of the mefarshim say non-kosher is bad for you and kosher is good for you. The problem is, empirically, you look around the average shul kiddush, and you see that that's not entirely true. Ask the average cardiologist about their patients, and you'll see that's not entirely true. Take the average cholesterol of the average kosher observant family, and you'll see that that's not entirely true. You could keep entirely kosher and be unhealthy. You could eat non-kosher and be healthy. That the health standard doesn't seem to hold up. So what's it all about? The Ramban says that the whole expression, the phrase, you are what you eat, you are what you eat, applies to kashrus. The animals that the Torah prohibits us to eat are animals of cruelty. They're animals that eat its prey. They're animals that exhibit negative, destructive, cruel behavior. And we imbibe, we absorb, we become what we eat. Literally. So that non-kosher has a spiritually poisonous effect. In the same way that there are people who are allergic to peanuts, and there are people who are allergic to wheat, and there are people who are allergic to all kinds of food, and physically they break out, physically they have a reaction to the food that they eat. So too, there's a spiritual reaction. There's a spiritual allergy to non-kosher food. And it's not random. It's because there is an energy in that non-kosher food, which is a negative energy. It's not some like Far East Buddhist language I'm describing. It's the Ramban, Nachmanides. And when we eat it, we've absorbed it. Which is one of the reasons we're so vigilant and scrupulous with kashrus, because it means even when you eat non-kosher by accident, it's not that you're liable upstairs. God's not going to hold you accountable for things that you didn't do intentionally, you weren't in control of. But the child who eats peanuts, who's allergic to peanuts, even if everybody did their best to be careful, school had its rules, and the parents, and the birthday party, and the plane didn't serve them, and peanuts, and everybody was careful. No one did anything, there was no negligence, and no malice involved. But the bottom line is, if the kid ate the peanuts, the kid's going to have an attack. So if we eat the non-kosher, even with all the best intentions of the world, there is a spiritually negative impact. Now, understanding that the commitment to kashrus is not all or nothing. There are people who are growing in their kashrus, and there are people who are learning, and there are people who are improving. And I don't mean to suggest that anyone who eats non-kosher or is growing in the path of keeping kosher is filled with poison and a spiritual cancer and is, you know, lethal and so on. Obviously, that depending on our background, where we're coming from, it's wonderful to be grown. But there's a spirituality to kashrus which is beyond just this random set of laws. The Rambam brings another approach, and I find the Rambam's approach personally to be the most meaningful. The Rambam is based off of a Medrash. The Medrash asks, does God really care where you shech the chicken, how many simanim, the trachea, and the esophagus, thank you, how much of it you cut, where you cut it, and what pressure is on it? Does God really care about that? Why does that really matter? The answer is, says the Rambam, God is trying to instill a sense of discipline in us. God is trying to cultivate our sense of discipline. That really, we spoke about this on Shabbat Shuvah a few years ago when we talked about that we don't have a neshama, we are a neshama, and we have a body. Every one of us is made up of two parts. We live in two dimensions simultaneously. There's the animal in us. We have an animal instinct and an animal impulse and an animal drive. We eat like an animal. Our room is a pigsty. Hopefully not us. We describe other people as your room looks like a pigsty and eating like an animal and so on. So there's the animal. We have a lot in common with animals. We have much in common with animals. But what we don't have in common, what makes us superior to the animals, is that we have the Tzelem Elokim, we have a godly soul. And the godly soul is defined as our capacity to be disciplined, dignified, sovereign, to rule over ourselves. The animal has an impulse and it acts. The animal has instinct and it does. The animal has a drive and it behaves. We have the ability to say, stop. Let me look at myself from outside myself. We have the ability, human beings are unique, animals don't have it. Human beings uniquely have the capacity for self-awareness, for who we are and how we behave and what this impact will be on us and who we want to be and what the results of these choices are. So kashrus, among all the mitzvahs that we have, and for the Rambam and again Shabbat Shuvah a few years ago, we developed the idea that all of Torah and mitzvahs, what we perceive as the minutiae, are there to refine within us and to support us in this battle, in this absolute war of the godly soul against the animal impulse, or what in Kabbalah they call the Nefesh Bahamas, and the Tzelem Elokim, the Nefesh Elokim Mamash, that we are literally a piece of God versus the fact that we have the animal makeup. So how do we win? Through mindfulness. Mindfulness is the way to win. How do you remember? Don't say that, don't look at that, don't eat that, don't cheat, don't pay, don't be honest, and don't be kind. How do you remember to always be disciplined and not to give in to that impulse, that instinct? Don't eat that, it's bad for you. Don't say that, it's bad for relationships. Don't think that, don't look at that, don't bend the rules there, cut corners there. How do you remember? How do you create that mindfulness? Torah and mitzvahs. Tie this shoe first before that shoe. The laws of Lashon Hara. Time-bound mitzvahs, of which women are exempt, but there are more exceptions to that rule than there are the rule. So as you know, there are many time-bound women, mitzvahs women are obligated in. But you add this whole lifestyle up, and the Torah tells us how to relate to time, how to relate to physical pleasure, how to relate to food, how to relate to people, how to relate to relationships. All of halacha is designed to create a sense of mindfulness so that we can be the people that we are meant to be, namely the godly soul, rather than give into and lead a life of the animal instinct, of the animal impulse. Kashrus, the Rambam says, maybe even more than all other mitzvahs, is there to reinforce this idea. If I'm careful about everything I put in my mouth, then I have the ultimate sense of discipline. So you have to understand, in my opinion, I got in trouble when I wrote this a couple years ago, when I was on my apology tour after all my blogs. So when everything at our table is kosher, but we stuff it in our face, or we spend too much money on it, or our recipes are too complicated, or we burden ourselves with having to prepare for Shabbos and all that. So we're actually, we may be keeping the letter of the law of Kashrus, but we're violating the spirit of the law of Kashrus. The spirit of the law of Kashrus is to be a godly soul. So when we eat in undisciplined, unhealthy, exorbitant, expensive, competitive ways, then we may be keeping the letter of the laws of Kashrus, but we're violating the spirit of the laws of Kashrus. The spirit of the law of Kashrus is to be mindful of everything that goes in our mouth. Not the spirit of the laws of Lashon Hara, is to be mindful of everything that comes out of our mouth. But the spirit of the laws of Kashrus are to be mindful about everything that goes in it. So you are tasked, because I'm assuming, maybe it's a unfair or misogynistic assumption, but I'm assuming that you're here in this room tonight, and you'll notice that we have not advertised. Matt Weisbaum didn't come to me with a 3-part series we have to do for men about the kosher kitchen. That you are the primary mashkichos in your kitchens, I'm assuming, right? And I think that one of the things, fairly or unfairly, that women are, you're the anchor for this mitzvah in your home, outside your home, in your community, in the birthday parties, the snacks, the school lunches, the family trips, the vacations, in every aspect of life. And so it's easy to get caught up in the minutia. We're going to spend the rest of our time right now on all the minutia, all the questions, dishwasher, the sink, the splat, we'll talk about all of that. But as we talk about all of that, you take notes and you'll have questions, and feel free to follow up anytime you like. I'm happy to answer any questions. Don't lose the forest for the trees. The reason we care about those minutia is to instill and to cultivate that mindfulness. So when we're shopping, even things that have a proper kosher symbol, but if they're bad for our family, they're spiritually not kosher, right? If we're serving in ways, if we're not careful, if we're undisciplined, if we're there's a spirit to the laws of kashrus to be able to reinforce and promote mindfulness, discipline, godliness, good health, and we shouldn't lose that forest for the trees. Okay, so now let's get to the laws of kashrus. Should we just go through these questions? Should we start with questions people have? All right, maybe we'll go through the questions. And then from there, see where that takes us and other questions people have. What's the deal with side-by-side sinks, the splashing, and so on? Question number one. What's the deal? All right, so let's talk about some broad principles of kashrus. There's the actual food, what halacha calls the mamashis, mamash, the actual material, the actual food itself, and that food has a status. Meat food is meat, dairy food is dairy. If it doesn't fit into either category, it is of course parav. We also have an area in halacha called tam. Tam means the food's ability to impart taste. When even the presence of the food is no longer there, whatever residual taste that's absorbed, for example, into the walls of the utensil, what's the status of tam? Tam ki ikar. Is the taste infused in the walls of the utensil, does it carry the status of the food itself, or is it insignificant? Is it negligible? Is it impossible? Meaning, if you boil a corned beef in a pot, and then you scrub that pot clean, let's say you scrub that pot so clean, if you sent it to a laboratory, there was no trace of the corned beef in the pot. Halachically, the pot would still be fleshings. Why? Because we paskin, again, this is a big sugya, I'm going to spare everybody the details of how we arrive at this conclusion, but we paskin tam kik, we paskin that the corned beef infused a taste into the walls of the pot, and even when the pot is clean, it retains the status of whatever was infused into it. Okay? Same would be true, obviously, if you boiled up macaroni and cheese. The walls of the pot would absorb, even when the pot was perfectly clean. Now, let's say you left that pot, and you didn't use it for 24 hours. How long does the taste infused in the wall of a utensil, how long does it remain potent? So, the Gemara says that midoraisa, biblically speaking, it remains potent for 24 hours. 24 hours. All else being equal. We're not talking about sharp foods. A sharp food like an onion or a radish has the ability to reawaken even a stale taste. But we're just talking about macaroni and cheese or boiled corned beef. I prefer the corned beef, but it's for the purposes of the conversation. So 24 hours after the pot is clean, the taste that's infused in the wall of the utensil is now considered spoiled. It's pugum. It's spoiled, it's stale. It's no longer potent or viable. That means to say, on a biblical level, and you have to stay for the next sentence, but for this sentence, on a biblical level, a pot 24 hours after it's clean goes back to being parv. right? Because whatever is absorbed in the wall is now stale. So the halachic terminology for this is ben yomo and eino ben yomo. Yomo means day. A ben yomo means it's within a day, within 24 hours. Eino ben yomo means it's outside a day, it's more than 24 hours. So the Ra'ah, one of the Rishonim, one of the medieval great halachic authorities in the back of the Gemara, the Ra'ah had one set of dishes. He cooked meat, his wife cooked meat, and then he waited 24 hours and used the same set of dishes for dairy. We don't pass them that way. Why? Because the Rabban Chazal came along and said, we're fearful that you're going to miscalculate. You're going to grab your pot 23 hours and 59 minutes after it was cleaned from the corned beef, and you're going to boil macaroni and cheese, and now you have a basa b'challah problem. Now you have a meat and milk problem. So we don't trust our ability, and that was certainly, you know, you're talking 2,000 years ago, you're talking before we had atomic clocks and watches and iPhone time and so on. So we're inexact in our timing. So Chazal said, no, you have to have separate utensils. And we don't rely on, we said, that you can't use an eino ben yomo, atu ben yomo. If we allow you to use something that wasn't used 24 hours, you'll come to use something which is 24 hours. Now, why is it important that I'm telling you this? Because what's one of the first questions I ever ask any of you when you email, text, call, Facebook, carrier pigeon, whatever you do? What's the first question when you say, I found the milk at 4 in the fridge, my husband put the lid, I used the spoon in the dairy. What's the first question I ask you? Was it used within the last 24 hours? Was it used? And why am I asking that question? Because if the spoon, or the pot, or the lid had not been used within the last 24 hours, then the food that was cooked in it is now completely viable. So let's say you had a dairy pot, and you cooked dairy food, and you used a meat spoon to mix it. Now you call Alfrante. Your husband used the meat spoon. He came home from work. He came home from work, and he had eaten. He grabbed the meat spoon, and he's eating right out of the pot before he even took his jacket off. And you call, you text, you know, God bless my husband. He used the meat spoon, the dairy food, the dairy pot. I say to you, when was the spoon used last? Because if the spoon wasn't used for 24 hours, so the food is kosher. The food is kosher because the spoon has no ability to impart a meat taste into your food, because whatever taste was in the spoon is now considered to be spoiled. It's considered to be not viable. It's no longer potent. So the first question will be, is it a ben yomo, inu ben yomo? Was it used within 24 hours? Was it not? Now let's forget the rest of this case right now. Do you have to kosher the spoon? Do you have to kosher the pot? I'm just trying to give you an example that the food, you've now saved the food. The food is not a problem because the food is not absorbed. Spoon for sure has to be koshered, and the pot, it depends on the ratio of the macaroni to the spoon, but the spoon for sure has to be koshered because it previously absorbed meat. It now absorbed dairy. You have to kosher it to go back to being meat. But you've saved the rest of your pot of macaroni and cheese. It's still kosher because the spoon had not been used. That's the first important principle.
Does it matter what material, the pot, spoon, anything? Like if it's one of those like wooden spoons or a plastic spoon? And
no, in this case, in that scenario, it doesn't matter the material. Okay, so that's all point number one is points one, two, and three, is that the difference between food that's mamashus, when you have actual food presence, you can't, unless that food is so caked in or burnt or spoiled that it's no longer considered viable food. But if you have real presence of food, it's real presence of food. It lasts until it's no longer considered edible. If you have no presence of food, but you have tam, you have the taste absorbed, so we pass in tam ki'ikr, the taste has the status of whatever food it was, and that's why we have designations of pots and silverware and the like, because what it absorbed will determine its status. After 24 hours, midoraisa, on the biblical level, the status is now nullified, the status is meaningless, because the food that was absorbed is considered no longer potent, and that has the consequences we talked about. And so those are all the first points.
Can I just ask?
Yes, sorry.
The spoon has to be cleaned more than 24 hours. Like if I have a dirty spoon,
correct.
Using it yesterday,
correct.
It was dirty.
The clock starts on the 24 hours from when it's cleaned. Exactly. And by the way, and if you have cooked parv with it previously, let's say you cooked meat last week with it, and 12 hours ago you used it to cook parv, then you're still okay. It's still an eino ben yomo. It's not a matter of when it was last used to cook. It's a matter of when it was last used to cook, the designating either meat or dairy. Yes?
Why isn't the food asur midirabanan?
The food is not asur midirabanan because there's Chazal, who established after 24 hours that we have to be careful, understood in situations like bidyevet, after the fact, hefsid maruba, they don't want you to waste the food. You can throw it out. There's no halachic reason to. Meaning, the whole reason they said you can't use the same utensils for both is to be careful so you don't get mixed up. But if you got mixed up, the reality is it can't have any negative impact on the food. So the food is clearly dairy. The spoon had no meat strength to it. That was already nullified more than 24 hours ago. So they said it's fine. The spoon has to be kosher, as we said, because it's absorbed both, but the food is going to be okay.
Does this have any problem with food just boiling?
Oh, yeah. Perfect segue. That's right where I was going to go. Oh, our chairwoman. So in order for taste to transfer, taste is only transferred through four mechanisms. I'm not going to talk about all of them because it'll be too confusing. The main one, 97% of the time, is heat. Food, taste. When we talked about Tom Kicker, that food is meaningful and taste is meaningful. Taste only transfers. It can transfer through the medium of heat. It can transfer through the medium of steam. It has to be hot steam. It can transfer through the medium of a knife. It's called duchka de sakina, the sharpness and pressure of the knife. So when you cut an onion, you'll say, well, there's no heat. When I cut the onion with the meat knife, and now that onion I can't use in a dairy recipe or with dairy, why? There's no heat. Because a davar charif, a sharp food combined with duchka de sakina, the blade of the knife, has the ability to impart taste also. There's also something called kavash kemevushal. I'm throwing a lot at you, but if you don't understand, it's fine. I'm going to come back to the heat in one second. Kavash kemevushal means pickling. Right? We know that empirically in cooking, pickling has the ability to cook food. You put a cucumber in brine, it's gonna cook it. You put raw, herring, lox, fish, in a brine, you're going to get, I don't know what you get. Herring? What do you get? Lox? Whatever you get. Whatever, I don't know what the examples are. I just know the rules. I don't know how it actually, But kavash kemevushal, when you pickle something, so that's also significant because it means that if you left, let's say you left, you by accident poured the leftover, that oily, juicy from the corned beef that you took it. Oh, thank you so much. You took the corned beef out of the pot you boiled the water in, and by accident someone poured the water when it was cold into a dairy pot. If it sat in a dick, terrible, disgusting, right? Your husband again, it was the husband. Husband needed the meat pot to make his whatever, so he just spilled it out, and he spilled it out into the dairy pot. Right. If that corned beef brine, we'll call it, sits in a dairy pot for more than 24 hours, your pot's now basar b'chalav. So, one second, I didn't heat anything up. How'd that happen? The answer is kavash kemevushal. If something sits more than 24 hours. If you have something sharp, so you know, it's corned beef. What name do we want to give that? The disgusting oil, water, post-corned beef cooking mixture. So that is not a sharp food. It takes 24 hours for that to imbue itself into the walls of a kli. Kavash kemevushal. If you had a sharp food, if you had something actually like a brine, a pickling agent, then even less than 24 hours. How long? That's a big machlokas. An hour, 2 hours, 12 hours, but even less than time than that. So the point is that there's a lot of ways that taste can transfer, but the primary weight that's going to be relevant to all of us is heat. How much heat? How much heat is necessary? So what's the next question I always ask you when you call me? First is, what is it used within 24 hours? What's the next question? Usually it has to do with things being washed in the sink and thing. I'll ask, how hot was the water? Usually the answer is I have to go ask my cleaning lady. But how hot was the water? Why does that matter? Because if the water was less than Yad Soled Espo, I'll define that in one second. If the water is less than Yad Soled Espo, that's not called hot. We have a halachic level that we call hot. Only above that level does taste transfer. Under that level, taste doesn't transfer. So I'll say to you, oh, she cooked the dairy and the meat in the same sink with the sponge and this together, but I found out it wasn't very hot. No problem. Just wash everything in cold water, no taste transferred. Just wash to make sure that you have no dirt residue on any of the utensils, and you can put it away.
What about the sponge?
Hold on. What is Yad Soled Espo? Hold that thought. What is Yad Soled Espo? So again, there's a machlokas, but we're strict to say 110, 120 degrees. What is Yad Soled Espo in practicality is, and again, this is an inexact science because people have different thresholds, but was it scalding hot? Did you have to take your hand? Were you able to wash the dishes with your hand under the water? If it was scalding hot and you had to take your hand away, you were in trouble. If you say, no, I was washing it all the time. So if you know that you're one of those people who can touch scalding water, it might have still been Yad Soled Espo, but most people can't. So you have to know where your threshold is of your sensitivity. But it's about 110, 120 degrees. If you know for sure it wasn't hot, no taste could transfer. Okay, so that's usually the next question. Was it used within 24 hours? And how hot was the water? What's the third question I'll often ask? Let's say we lost on both of those. Yes, it was used within 24 hours, and yeah, the water was really hot. What's the third question? Was there detergent or soap used? Why do we ask that? Because in halacha we have something called a davar apogim. Right? Just like the taste infused within the walls of the utensil after 24 hours becomes nullified, becomes negligible, becomes It doesn't have any strength to it. When you add an agent of something that is acidic or something that is negative, something that takes away, that's you couldn't consume, like detergent, that has the ability to be what's called pogame, right? It accelerates the process. So after 24 hours, all taste is no longer viable. But if you add an agent that's pogame, so then immediately the taste is no longer viable. So when you wash the dishes or the silverware and there was a detergent or a soap that was used, that in itself will nullify whatever taste was imbued within the utensil, within the cutlery. Those are the three questions. Yes?
I'm not thinking of dishwashing, not the dishwasher.
Yes, so in most dishwasher, exactly. That's why in 99.9% of the dishwasher, if the soap is what?
Like I put the soap in the thing.
Right.
And then there's water and I hear the soap coming out later.
It's still okay. Because it eventually comes out and it's going to nullify the taste of everything that was present.
So you don't have to
rewash
that spoon?
No. 99.9% of the dishwasher, again, I hesitate to say this because people should not be less careful with dishwashers because I'm about to say this. Everyone should still be obviously very careful with dishwashers and don't lose the forest for the trees. Trying to become disciplined, godly spirits, all that stuff. Okay, good. But in the dishwasher, if you're using detergent whenever you run your dishwasher, 99.9% of the cases you're going to be okay. And Rav Moshe has specifically, I don't want to call it kula, but he paskins that in most of the cases, just if you found that dairy spoon in the fleshy dishwasher, leave it out, don't use it for 24 hours, and then you could use it again. Why? Why is that Rav Moshe's psak? Because if you leave it out for 24 hours, it's automatically kosher. Midoraisa. And the rabbi said, don't rely on that, but you're not relying on it l'chatchila, you're relying on it b'dieved, where you happen to find it in your dishwasher. So in most dishwasher cases, if you have detergent, you're going to be safe. And anyway, we'll say, leave it 24 hours, don't use it if you want to be super safe. But that's going to be most of the cases. Yes?
So you're only talking about utensils right now, because Tupperware and those things, you put in the dishwasher, and you put in the wrong dishwasher, then you have an issue. So
No, or in the dishwasher. The Tupperware also. We paskin that hard plastic is kasherable. We paskin that hard plastic you can kasher.
So what's soft plastic? Like something not Tupperware?
Yeah, like a plastic bag. I don't know if that's soft plastic. Or plastic utensils. The utensils we use for plastic. We call it hard plastic, but it's all kasherable.
So the spatulas that are rubber.
Yeah, it's all kasherable.
So there's no soft plastic?
Yeah, I don't know that in a practical way. We call the plastic that we use on handles and the like hard plastic, but hard plastic, it's a machlokas, a poskim. There is a debate about hard plastic, but most of the poskim and most of the agencies use it. So I'll give you this as an example. When the OU or the Star K or the OK or the Huff K or the major kosher organizations go into a factory or plant and they want a kosher between the non-kosher run of the food product and the kosher run, they don't always have the luxury of waiting 24 hours because the factory is not willing to shut down and lose the revenue or lose the productivity of the 24 hours. So they'll introduce a davar apogim. They'll introduce a nullifying agent. So they'll run some acidic wash through the line, and that allows them to now treat it as an eno ben yomo, so they can then kasher. We don't do this on a residential basis. We don't, because eim avatlan is lachatchila. We don't nullify things intentionally, so we don't rely. You're not allowed to, you know, you don't have that, like, you know, the fleshy pot, you really need it for milchik, so you'll just like pogame quickly. And, we don't rely on that, but I'm giving an example in a commercial setting. In a commercial setting, the big kosher agencies will rely on that. Okay? So again, tam ki ikar, taste is viable. It becomes infused into pots. And taste is absorbed into the pot, and then the taste is purged from the pot into our foods. Right? Taste goes both ways. For most things. There are things that taste cannot go both ways, like ceramic, where it only gets imbued, but you can't get it out. That's why ceramic, we paskin, you can't kosher. So if your husband's going to make mistakes, he should do it with silverware. He should do it with glassware. He should not do it with ceramic or pottery or, I don't know, what do you call these things? China, clay. But those things absorb, but they can't purge, so you can't kosher. You can't kosher. Glass, what?
Done.
Sayonara. Yeah.
Done.
The dishwasher, there might be the leniency of the Devra Po game and wait, right, correct.
How about a rubber spatula? Like
rubber spatula can be kosher. It can be kosher. Wood is a little more tricky. It depends how many cracks there are in the wood. If the wood has remained smooth, then we paskin it's absorbed and can purge. If the wood has a lot of cracks and crevices where you have real food could get stuck in there, then we're strict to not kosher wood. Yes?
When I was in Monsi, when we had the
chicken scandal. Yeah.
And we were told that china, ceramic, but real bone china, the one that you can see through the light, is kosherable.
So china is a big discussion. The Chacham Tzvi has a tshuva where, and this is the leniency everybody quotes, it says in circumstances of either extreme loss, china is very expensive, a mistake was made, and or so on, and people are becoming religious, they're kosher in their kitchen, now they want to know, can they kosher their china? So in a situation of extreme loss, of a family antique or heirloom, something that can't be replaced, so he will allow it to be koshered by waiting, not 24 hours, but 12 months. In Muncie, I'm sure they didn't say 12 months. But 12 months, and then you actually do hagala 3 times on it. You dip it in boiling water 3 times. We rely on that leniency in cases of extreme loss, antiques. There are sometimes a person says, I have a set of china I got from my wedding 30 years ago. 4 of the plates broke. I found online where you can get it, but it's used or you don't know where, and can you do that? There are circumstances where we rely on the leniency today. In Muncie, they probably allowed you to kosher it right away, because even though they too paskin that you can't kosher china, strictly speaking, there were so many doubts that it was 10 steps removed, right? Did you buy the chicken that wasn't kosher? And if you did you cook it? And if you cooked it that day, did it go on that plate? And if one on that plate, was it still hot? And what, if you add all that up, you can arrive at where you can be lenient about the plates, which is probably why they were.
No, but at that time, we were told that real china, which like I said,
is a different level.
The one that is transparent,
it's kosherable even in general.
Right.
Okay, that could be. That could be. So china, the other one is glass. Glass is a machlokas between the Sfaradim and Ashkenazim on Pesach. Right? We paskin, Ashkenazim say that the entire year glass neither absorbs nor pours, nor purges. It's not porous. Glass is what it is. We don't rely on that for hot Ashkenazim, but we do for cold. You could use that same glass to drink cold I don't know what meat cold thing you would drink, but whatever that would be, and then you could use it to drink milk and so on. Sfaradim are even more lenient, and on Pesach, though, Ashkenazim are stricter with glass. Okay, but I'm getting too far away from what we wanted. I just wanted to say some of the principles. So no same time. We have the concept of no same time, tam kiker, that taste infuses. 24 hours later, it's stale. It's no longer viable. Nevertheless, obviously, we're strict to have different utensils. The concept of a davar pogame, an agent that's pogame, that can nullify whatever taste was present. Yes?
Was that a part of my, in a meat dishwasher or a dairy dishwasher?
Yeah.
Would that be okay with that cleanup?
It depends how well you wash off your dishes before you put them in the dishwasher. Meaning, if there is actual meat or dairy in the dairy dishwasher in there with it, it's best not to. It's best to run separate power of cycles or to wash them separately. But if you did and there was detergent, then you could still consider it parv afterwards.
Sponge,
yeah, we were avoiding that sponge question, weren't we? If the sponge was used, that was the question. Was the water hot?
Let's say no.
So you want to know about the utensil or about the sponge itself?
Well, we said the utensil.
So the sponges are so inexpensive. When in doubt, throw it out, use a new one. The dairy sponge was used with the hot thing and it was hot water. And just use a new sponge. There might be, you might be able to be lenient, but the thing they use a sponge on. So most sponges are probably clean before you use it, right? Because I imagine I myself, when I've cleaned dishes, at the end you squeeze out the sponge or you run it under the water. So it's unlikely that there was actual meat or dairy on it. So assuming there was soap used also, then you can rely on that. Okay, what are the general overall principles? Decide whether we should get confusing here. So no Saint Tom means the ability to infuse taste within the walls of the utensil. Then we get to another area called no Saint Tom bar no Saint Tom, or otherwise known as not bar not, the initials, the acronym, not bar not, which stands for no Saint Tom bar no Saint Tom, which means it's twice removed. So you boiled your corned beef in your meat pot, and then you cleaned your meat pot, and now you cooked your noodles in your meat pot. Let's say even within 24 hours. So your noodles, can they be eaten? Can you put them in a plastic bowl and melt cheese on top of it?
Yes.
Some say yes, some say no. So this is something called no Saint Tom, bar no Saint Tom. The noodles are twice removed, right? The meat was cooked in the utensil, then the utensil was cleaned and cooked the parv. So it's no Saint Tom, bar no Saint Tom. you're kind of twice removed from the original meat taste that you're trying to avoid. So here it depends. If the pot was not used for 24 hours, and now you cooked your noodles, then you're allowed to melt cheese on the noodles. If the pot was used within 24 hours, and you cook noodles, Ashkenazim cannot melt cheese, Sfaradim can melt cheese. Machlokas Shulchan Aruch and Ramah. Okay, hold on. I know we just generated a lot of excitement in the room. Correct. You should not write. Shiro's raising a very important point. Thank you. The caveat. It's machlok is machaber Ramah. But the Ramah, at least for Ashkenazim, we paskin that you should not intentionally boil noodles in a meat pot with the intent of melting the cheese. It's that when your kid goes to the fridge, takes out the noodles, says, I want to melt cheese, it's the only thing I'm willing to eat for lunch today, and you remember you made it in a meat pot, and you remember it wasn't used for 24 hours, it's okay. You're allowed to. Again, it's applying all of our principles. You can... Right, they can get confused because they don't know was the pot used, not used, and so on. But if you want to know the halacha, that's the halacha. Chinuch, I'll let you decide what's best to teach your kids. But in terms of the halacha, that is the status of no simtam bar mitzvah. What?
Extra noodles, you're making it. Correct.
You shouldn't make noodles with the intent of melting the cheese later. It's if you made the noodles later, you can decide you're going to melt the cheese on it.
Yeah. Maybe have extra leftover.
Yeah, you know, you made the noodles to make noodles. Maybe you had the noodles with meatballs, maybe you just had noodles. Yes. Let's say it one more time. Okay. If you have a, based on the principles of not bar not, you have a meat pot that you boiled noodles in. A clean meat pot that you boiled noodles in. That was not used in 24 hours for meat. You should not intentionally boil noodles you want to melt with cheese in that meat pot. But if you boiled the noodles because you were just boiling noodles, you thought you were just going to add ketchup, or you used it to serve with meatballs or whatever reason, and then afterwards you or your child or somebody wanted to melt cheese, you'd be allowed to. That's
in a
not true.
Microwave and whatever. Like there's nothing wrong with
correct. That. Correct. I mean, put it in a plastic bowl or whatever, it's
not in your dairy dishes?
Put it in paper. No, but I'm thinking you could even put it in your dairy because if you can melt cheese onto it,
so
you can put it in your dairy.
Right.
It's not bar not. Not bar not lahatera. Not bar not lahatera. Yeah. No. Correct. Once you have the noodles, that's exactly the lashon that the nosekel shachan taseh. Once you have the noodles, lichatchila, you can melt the cheese onto it, but you can't make the noodles with intent to melt the cheese. You have it in the fridge. You know it's made in a meat pot not used 24 hours. You can later decide you're going to melt cheese.
So what if the noodles are still in the pot? You're sitting down, you're having your salt and spaghetti cuisine.
Yeah.
And your child says, there's no way I'm eating that, can't have the cheese.
Not a problem.
So the noodles are still hot.
Still okay.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
What if you started off in the pot? You said 12 in the pan.
Then it has, no, you shouldn't switch. You shouldn't switch it to once you start a cooking. Start once it started. I wouldn't switch between pots because depending how hot that you run around.
Even the meat container is okay. Oh, the meat container has to be not years, but then 24 hours.
Meat container is cold.
Yeah.
Cold has no impact on it. Remember, it takes heat to transfer taste.
Right.
But you said that even if it was used within 24 hours, you can melt cheese onto it.
Like an hour ago, I cleaned it. And
right. Said, yeah. 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 Yes.
Sometimes the same thing for vice versa. Like you cook the noodles in a
dairy pot. Yep.
That hasn't been used 24 hours.
Throw some meatballs on them.
And then you decide you want some meat
sauce. Yep. Now again, I want to be clear about this. You can't make the noodles with the intent, thank you, Shira, with the intent of doing it with the opposite. But if you made the noodles called stam, then later you can add what you want to. Right, you made noodles for the week and now you made a big pot of noodles and... Right. Right. Okay, that's based on not bar not lahatera. Yes. Diane.
Could you clarification.
Yes.
Tardam, I can have the intent.
No.
No.
Tardam, I believe actually. I'm not 1,000% positive. No, I'm going to double check. I'm not 1,000% positive, but I believe Sephardi may even be able to have the intent. But certainly, even within 24 hours, you're allowed to. Ashkenazim only after 24 hours. Okay, that's called not barnat to hetera. Now, where all bets are off on not barnat is when onions are involved. Onions called a davar charif. A davar charif, an onion, a radish, it's a big machlokas. What's called a davar charif? Lemons are not. They're not. Garlic is a machlokas. There's a debate. What isn't called a davar charif? But a davar charif, what we'll call a sharp food, not spicy, but sharp. A sharp food has the ability to renew whatever taste was in the pot and makes it come alive even if it's been more than 24 hours. It also has the ability to transfer taste.
Garlic so, too.
What?
Garlic
is a machlokas. But I think most are lenient.
Onion.
Onion is the primary one. So if you cut onion with a meat knife, you can't use that onion with dairy. You shouldn't eat that onion with dairy. And vice versa, if you cut it with a dairy knife, what? No, it does not have the ability to make you meat or dairy. What it has the ability to do is it becomes like power food cooked in a meat pot within 24 hours. So the onion becomes like a food that was cooked in a meat pot within 24 hours. That's it. Now, by the way, just to be clear, if I eat noodles that were made in a meat pot, even if the meat pot was used an hour ago and then cleaned, if the meat pot was used 10 minutes ago and then cleaned, I don't have to wait at all after eating those noodles. It doesn't make me fleshix. It just can't be eaten with dairy, but it doesn't make me fleshix. So too, if I cut the onion with a meat knife and I put it, I can't use it with dairy, but if I were to eat that onion, I wouldn't become meat having to wait.
But it has to be in meat dishes.
But it should be in meat dishes.
Could you cut off the end of the onion with a sharp knife and then the second half of it you use for something else?
I think it's a bad idea. Yeah. We have little Ziploc bags with half onions with either an M or a D written outside of it in our, you know. That's what goes on in our fridge. Okay, so onions change bets. Yeah, I think so. I think so. There is an opinion, the Aruch HaShulchan believes that onions that are fried, I shouldn't tell you this, it's not practical, but onions that are fried in oil, he says it takes away their harifas. He just said onion is considered davar charif. We don't paskin like the Aruch HaShulchan, but we do paskin like the Pischei Tshuva. The Pischei Tshuva quotes that once the onion is cooked, it's no longer sharp. So if it's added to that other thing, so if I cut an onion with a meat knife and then I put it into a dairy recipe, I now have it's treif. But let's say we had the shayla actually last week or 2 weeks ago. If somebody
the pot or the food,
both the pot should be kosher and the food is no good. If you cut, however, an onion with a meat knife and you sauteed it in a meat pan and then you took that onion and you put it into but you put it into something dairy, it's possible there's other factors involved. It depends on the ratio. There's a lot of other factors. But a cooked onion doesn't have the sharpness that the raw onion has. So you wouldn't view it the same way as you would the sharp onion. Okay, so these are some of the overarching principles that help you then fit in all the other details that we're going to talk about why the rules are the way they are.
What about frozen onion? Is any different than the cooked onion?
I guess once it thaws in the cooking process, it becomes sharp. It becomes like a raw onion.
The cooking that changes it.
Yeah, I think it would make it.
You're talking about the little cubes.
Yeah.
The little cubes.
Yeah.
Are processed.
Ah.
They're not only onion. The oil. There's oil and salt in there. So
interesting. So the Aruch HaShulchan might be leaning there, calling it not a. Yeah, I don't know.
This Shabbat we had. First time I saw this on the garlic, on the frozen little cubes of garlic, it says Lo Hashashli Nat Laila. And I had never heard about it.
Interesting.
So we had a whole big.
That in itself is right.
New
what Anita's referencing is the Gemara says there's certain foods that you should not leave uncovered overnight. A peeled egg, peeled garlic,
onion,
things should not be uncovered overnight. Most poskim today say that you don't need to. We actually had a big ORB debate about this about 6 months ago. Should we require our ORB restaurants to follow this, which could come at a loss for them? Right, so Chabad, it's based on mystical reasons, and it's based on reasons of rodents having access to food that we don't believe today and leaving their poison in it. So, yeah. What?
You don't think your restaurants put their food in
it? No, we do. So I'm saying, no, but it would appealed uncooked egg, not uncooked, there's no something appealed uncooked egg. Appealed uncooked garlic that's in a refrigerator, many people wouldn't use overnight. They would require you to.
But that's very unusual, people who appeal.
Today, most people, again, it depends on your orientation. Chabad will be makbid on all this.
Crushed, that's why the crushed garlic,
right,
has a little bit of salt.
And that's enough to not call it. So that's right. So putting salt is a way to avoid it, which is, I think, the conclusion of the ORB was telling them to put salt if they're going to have, let's say sometimes they make raw eggs that they make a mixture out of that they didn't cook at all, so it's sitting in a container. Can that be overnight? Like I said, it was a big ORB discussion. Should we make them salt it? Should we make them throw it out?
No, it's
right. Well, certain things are issues of being uncovered, and certain things are issues of
just being
right, cracked and not cooked. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's go through some of these questions now that we have some of the principles. What's the deal with the side-by-side sink? Sink. So now let's apply our principles to sinks. Right. So right now we come back full circle to the sinks. So in the ideal world, limitless amount of money, and you got to design your own kitchen. You're going to have two sinks, maybe even three sinks, a part of sink. You'll have two sinks far away from each other, no problem. Your meat sink, your dairy sink. Everybody's happy. Shalom Yisrael. Shalom bias, it's all good. In the non-perfect world, which exists for many people, and certainly at different stages of their life, you have one sink, which you're relying on for both meat and dairy. So what do you do with one sink for meat and dairy? What do you do with your utensils? So there are different approaches to this. What you should not do is ever have meat and dairy dishes stacked in the same sink at the same time. Why? Because if you turn on the water and it's Yad Soletis Bo and the water hits the meat and the dairy sink, touching the meat and dairy food still in the sink, then you're going to trafe up your dishes. That's a problem. So the first thing is that you should wash your dishes separately between meat and dairy. Some say even when you have sinks side by side, don't have both at the same time. Make sure one sink is empty before you're putting in the other sink. To avoid it. I don't think it's a stringency that you have to keep. I think if they're separate sinks, you're okay. But in the same sink, you shouldn't have them there at the same time. So what do you need to do? So this is machlokas haposkim. There are poskim who say you need a sink insert. And so you get a plastic basin with a hole in the bottom so the water can drain. And you have one for meat and one for dairy. Rav Moshe has an interesting tshuva. And the basis of his tshuva is very interesting. He says essentially, in maybe much more politically correct terms, but the women are going to rebel. That's so impractical. How could we burden our women with having them essentially change over sinks every time between meat and dairy? So Rav Moshe says, all you need are different racks on the bottom. Put a different meat rack and a dairy rack. How does that work? What about the sink itself? Doesn't the sink become treif? He says it's not a problem as long as you avoid the sink clogging and the water building up till it gets the height of the dishes. Why? Why? So here we have more principles. When we talked about heat having the ability to transfer taste, it's in a kli rishon. If it's in the primary utensil in which the cooking is happening, then the heat has the ability to transfer taste. But what about in a kli sheni? What about in a kli sheni? So let's say I heated meat. Let's say I have chicken soup. And then I take a ladle, and I take out some of the chicken soup, and I pour it into a dairy bowl. Does the, in a kli sheni, a secondary utensil, does that have the ability? Let's say kli shlishi and so on and so forth. So certain foods have the ability to transfer in a kli sheni, and certain foods don't. Then you have something called iroi kli rishon, which is, let's say you take it from the primary pot in which it was cooked, and you pour it, onto something, and it hits it. So iroi kli rishon has the ability to impart taste. So Rav Moshe's calculation is the following. This is a little confusing. If you don't follow, it's fine. Rav Moshe's calculation is, he says, what's the problem? The only time the sink, which is not kosher, right? Because your sink has absorbed both meat and dairy. And that's why you have the rack, so the dishes don't sit on the bottom of the sink. How is it possible that the sink would be able to impart a non-kosher taste into your utensil if the water coming from the faucet hit the wall of the sink at the point where it meets your utensil? At that moment was Yad Soletis. He says that's lo shchiach. That doesn't happen. You don't have to worry about that. So Rav Moshe is lenient and allows just a meat sink rack and a dairy sink rack. Switch over the racks, and you don't need to do more than that in one sink. That's how to use one sink. What if you have two sinks side by side? I think that was the original question. What's the deal with a side by side sink? So, I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but sometimes you have. Right. So, some say you should cover the sink that you're not using. to avoid splashes that are going into the next sink. So in Israel, they often have a partition between the sinks, like a ridge that comes up to blocks the splashing. But I don't think the metal sinks that we have that. I don't think the sink cover is necessary. I do think it's a better idea not to have meat dishes in the meat sink while you're washing the dairy dishes with hot water and it's splashing and everywhere and making a mess. So if you wash with cold, for sure you're okay. If in the other sink you don't have stings, then just rinse it out before you then put what? Then you're likely not at Yatzalei as well. Right. But again, there are people with different thresholds who can, some people can touch very hot water, and or some people are wearing gloves while they're washing the dishes. So they're using very hot water. So yeah, if
some milk splatters into the meat, so what happens?
Rinse it with cold water.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah, rinse it with cold water. And you're okay. Okay, question number two.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
In a situation with one sink, why can't the sink be dairy and you only need a wrap when you're washing meat?
You can do that.
Need separate wraps?
No, that you need because with the food, you have to worry that the hot water hit meat food as it hit the bottom of the sink, and the hot water hits dairy food as it hits the bottom of the sink. So the bottom of the sink is treif. You're essentially treating the sink as treif, and you're using the rack to elevate the utensils so that nothing's.
If you treated it like meat and only had a rack for dairy, then if it hit,
the exactly,
came back up.
Then it's going to be, then your sink is treif.
Even if we're assuming that you're not doing yatzalei.
If you're never doing yatzalei bowl, so your sink never becomes anything. But we should assume at some point somebody used hot water while there was. You're cleaning out the chullen pot. You're cleaning out. You clean something where you're using hot water. Or you're boiling, right? Or you're boiling the pouring the. Right, the corned beef water, which is still hot. Yeah. Right. What happens if by accident your kid throws it? That's very kind. Your kid, not your husband, throws a dairy spoon which was just used into the fleishig sink. So you tell me the answer. Why is it fine? Because your kid wasn't using a yatzalei spoon to eat whatever they ate. It's cold. So you rinse off the sink, rinse off the spoon, everything with cold water, and it's fine. It's not a problem. What? Yeah, you could use everything immediately. Not a problem. Okay, the next questions deal with ovens. So we'll talk about ovens. Should we keep going?
Yeah.
Stop here?
Okay.
I can ask one last question. There's nothing to like burying the spoon. I remember that from
knives. Newts is a separate. Had a kasha knives. Stick it in the ground, bury it. Yeah.
We'll talk about
that. There's something to that. Yeah, that's not just TBGB. Okay. Let's talk about ovens for a minute. Yes. Yeah.
That's what I asked.
You did that on purpose, you're saying.
Accent.
Right. Husband used the fleshed spoon with the cereal. So
where are you washing your sink?
You can, first of all, you can wash in the bathroom sink if you really want to be careful. You go laundry room, the bathroom sink, right? That's where you wash, the baby's bottles on Pesach, because kidney us like that's you have that treif sink in your house somewhere. But the truth is, strictly speaking, you could, if you're using cold water, you could wash it in the dairy sink. You're just washing. You're washing, or the meat sink, and you're putting it back in the drawer. You're just rinsing it with cold water. You're rinsing everything. You're okay.
And
what?
An
empty sink. Right, exactly. An empty sink. Okay, let's talk about ovens for a few minutes. Let's apply our principles to ovens. So you make food in an oven. You make a lasagna in the oven. And the lasagna is sitting
dairy.
In a... What?
A dairy.
A dairy lasagna.
Well, people make
okay, no, good. A dairy lasagna. Dairy lasagna. Hungry. A dairy lasagna. You make a dairy lasagna in an oven, uncovered. And it's sitting in a dairy utensil and it's on the oven rack. And now you come and you're making a turkey. Assuming you eat turkey. Let's go to our corned beef. Right? First we boiled our corned beef and now we're glazing it and we're cooking the corned beef. Uncovered. What's the problem with the oven? How is your oven becoming kosher or non-kosher? Oh, so one thing to worry about is splatter. So if you have spills in your oven, so you're going to have real problems. How else does the oven become impacted? Zeya, steam. We paskin steam. Again, here's a machlokas from a davar lach, from a liquid. For sure, everybody agrees. that steam has the status of the liquid. So when you boil a liquid and it produces steam, the steam is essentially the status of your liquid, which is why it's really important. Some fancy kitchens, they have like a rack to hang utensils over the stovetop, so you could have ladles and spoons and things hanging there. It's a problem, because if you're boiling meat, dairy, steam rises, the utensils that are hanging over the oven can become... Some even say, I'm not telling you you have to do this, some even say you should be very careful when you're spicing your food as it's boiling. You put it in your hand and put it in. Don't hold your spice right over the chicken soup, because the steam is going through the holes of your spice, and your pepper, your salt, your garlic powder, your whatever, is now becoming fleishiks or milchiks. So some say you should either have separate spices, put it in your hand and then put it in, be at enough of a distance. Some say the holes are too small, the spices are coming out, there's no way steam's going in. Does it clog up? Okay. So if it clogs up, that's evidence that the steam is going in. So you should be careful, right? The hood over the oven is for sure true. Right? Our hoods have absorbed fleishiks, milchiks, all kinds of steam. Right? So this is a very important... With spices? You should be... Look. Well, what? If it really, again, empirically, if the steam is getting in and it's getting clumpy, because then some have separate spices, or some are careful to always put it in their hand, or they throw it in from it, they pull the pot over. I guess the pot over won't help you, but I don't know. They figure it out. The point I'm trying to get across is that steam has the status of the liquid that produced that steam. Right? So that's important. It's important also for your urn. Right? If you release your urn, if you release hot water from your urn into a cup that has meat or dairy and it produces a steam, the spout of your urn could be impacted to become meat or dairy.
But if it's a clean cup,
you're fine. But let's say you have, I don't know, you made your coffee backwards. So you put milk on the bottom of your cup before you added the coffee in the water, then the water hits the... But I guess that would be a bad example, because your milk is cold. There also it's a bad example because it's cold. It would have to be because it was hot and the steam coming up from it.
Hot water to the cold milk makes it hot.
What?
Adding the water to the milk makes the milk hot again.
Yeah, but it won't cook the milk instantaneously, so that the steam of it will be milk. But yeah, you made a cup of coffee, you're drinking it, you're halfway through and you want to heat it up, you want to add some more hot water, so now you're putting the hot water in. You just have to be careful about the way you're doing it.
What if you add water to your tongue?
That's what I just said.
You don't do it from the spout.
Your sink spout, you're saying. You pull out the sink spout? Oh, to your urn. Correct. Yeah, no, that's a good question. You're correct, that's the only way to add the hot water. But is the steam coming up? It's for sure like the... It's a good question. And it's less than 24 hours. You want that coffee the next morning? I'll look into that. It's a good question. The question was that you have your hot challah pot. It's a halacha for Hilchos Shabbos for next time or two times from now. But let's say you see it's drying out. You want to add water to it. You're allowed to on Shabbos. If the challah can't be on the fire, so you have to take the insert out of the crock pot or move it off the blech. And you can only add it from a kli rishon. So you're saying you take it right from your hot water urn and release some water into your challah pot. So the steam is piping out of your challah right to the spout of your hot water urn. You did that Friday night when you saw it was drying out before you went to bed. Now Shabbos morning you want your cup of coffee. Isn't the spout releasing water, which is essentially bisari? Okay, you're allowed to add milk to that water. I will, let me look into that for next time. I don't think of a way around that right away. Let's get back to our oven. So we got on this detour because we were talking about the fact that steam has the status. So when it comes to a liquid, steam has a status. When it comes to a solid, it's a machlokas. And that's why we paskin, for the most part, a solid is not going to produce a real steam in the oven. But sometimes we have a lot of solids which are somewhere in between. Because they're a solid that has a sauce. A solid that has a liquid. It's cooking in a liquid. So the walls of the oven become... The issue in an oven is steam. The walls of the oven become trafe or absorb through steam. And the walls of the oven impart taste through steam. So how do you get around it? So there are three ways to get around it. Three ways to use one oven for both meat and dairy. One way is that you cover... Let's say this. One way is that you kosher it in between. You can run a self-clean kosher, and then you can even kosher within 24 hours of having just used it. Or you can run it by putting it on the highest setting for an hour, in which case you should wait 24 hours before you do that. What's the difference? Two methods of koshering. One's called libun kal, one's called libun chamor. Libun kal, which is a lighter method of koshering, requires you to wait 24 hours before you kosher. By the way, now you understand why we always say, let's say before Pesach or Haggalah, wait 24 hours before you kosher, because then you're really, strictly speaking, from a biblical perspective, it's already kosher. You're just doing an additional level. So if you're doing libun kal, you have to wait 24 hours. Libun chamor, if you're doing a strong koshering, where the heat buildup of a self-clean oven is considered a libun chamor, then you could even do it right away. So one way is to kosher your oven between meat and dairy every time. Not necessarily so practical, but it is one way. Yes?
Does it matter the order? If you're waiting the 24 hours or you're running the hot oven first?
What do you mean? If you're...
Wait
24 hours and then leave it on the highest setting for an hour. Or run the self-clean right away. The oven should be clean. The oven has to be clean, wait 24 hours, highest setting for an hour, or run the self-clean.
Is broil the highest setting on the oven?
That is way over my pay grade. I don't know, is broil that the highest? Is that the hottest? Yeah, so the answer would be yes. What if it's what? The glass on top? Yeah? So then maybe less time. So 500, don't do less than broil. Yes? The bottom or the top? Right, right. So I get it right. Either way, the same temperature. Okay, so coming back, ladies. So you can either kosher your oven in between, and those are the two methods of koshering. Clean it, wait 24 hours, highest setting for an hour, or run the self-clean even right away. The second option is you could cover everything you put in your oven. Why? Because when you cover everything you put in your oven, no steam is escaping, your oven gains no status, no steam re-enters, and you're good to go. The third option is that you designate your oven either as milchik or fleshik, whichever you're going to use your oven for most, and anything you cook in there of that designation could even be uncovered. And then when you cook in the opposite designation, you cover it in a way carefully that no steam can enter. You don't have to double cover. You don't have to double cover. Maybe that's just caution so steam can't get in, but you don't have to double cover from the perspective of double cover. I'll tell you where double cover comes from. Double cover, here's another rule. Taste can only transfer when there's a liquid medium. So if a hot dairy pot, a burning hot dairy pot, touches a burning hot meat pot, they're both perfectly kosher. If you have a little water between them, they transfer taste, they're not kosher. So without a liquid medium, two kalim, two utensils can't transfer taste. That's why we double cover. When you double cover something, you're creating two utensils, one within the other, so that even when the outside cover becomes not kosher, it can't transfer anything to the inside cover. That's why when you go on an airplane, they double wrap the food. Because they could even heat it in a trafe oven, because nothing, if you go away to a hotel, you can find yourself a scenario where you need to heat something in a non-kosher oven, you could double wrap it, and by double wrapping it, you're creating a utensil within a utensil. A utensil within a utensil with no liquid medium between the two has no ability to transfer taste. So maybe that's why people double cover. I think they double cover to be careful, to be sure that no steam is getting in.
In that situation where you're in this hotel or whatever, and you're double covering it in a trafe oven, you're covering the entire...
All the way around. The whole day. Correct. Not just the top, all the way around. Just like on the LL flight when you have to undo the bag and then take out the...
Is the container considered a cover?
Yeah. It's one wrapping of the food.
You can put one layer on top and then wrap the...
Oh, no. I would do two layers of tinfoil around it. container. Correct. I would do two layers of tinfoil around it.
So that's only in a tray oven, not for...
Only in a tray oven, right. So coming back to our scenario, I have my meat oven. I need to make a... I think the issue is that many of the dairy dishes need to be uncovered, right? Yeah. That's Shavuos. Yes. That's when you get into the whole thing. Right, so that's not so practical. But let's say you're okay covering it. I have my meat oven, but I'm going to make a lasagna. I just make sure it's sealed. I close it tightly with aluminum foil around. No steam can escape, and therefore it's not a problem to make it in the same oven.
But what if it starts dripping? You doubled it up, or even
if it's dripping,
and then it just drips
anyway. Again, if it's covered well, even when it's dripping, your oven may be chafed, but that steam has no ability to get back inside the utensil.
But then you have to clean it.
But then your oven needs to be kosher because your oven absorbed both. But your oven will be.
What about fish and meat?
Ah, fish and meat. Hold off on fish and meat. Fish and meat with barbecues and hold off on fish and meat. Parv, what was the parv question?
If you use the, let's say you cook dairy lasagna.
Yeah.
And then you want to cook, that's your Thursday night dinner, you want to cook dessert for Shabbos. So you want to use...
You cooked, say that again, you cooked a dairy lasagna.
Right, for dinner.
Yeah.
And then you want to make brownies for
that. Right.
So brownies are...
So again, you should know brownies, according to most poskim, are not going to produce steam. So you don't even have a problem. Challah, baked goods. Most poskim, again, don't hold me because I don't know the foods that well. But there are many foods that won't create real steam. Real steam is when there's a liquid there. Or when there's a liquid, I guess brownies are a batter. So maybe that's more... Like cakes, but a challah won't produce steam enough to have to worry about this.
So can you eat the
challah? You can treat your challah cooked in a meat oven that made a corned beef 2 hours ago as pariv, because we paskin the challah is not going to create steam. Assuming your oven is clean. Assuming your oven is clean. If your oven has a puddle on the bottom of sauce from the corned beef.
Cheese on it, if you have two ovens, then one oven is inflation, one oven is milk. Like you can do your baking for anything for Shabbos.
I don't want to say you're baking for anything because I don't know all the baking, how thin the batter and the... But let's say your challah. The brownie, I don't know because it's a batter and the steam it produces.
Because we're only eating it for dessert, so it doesn't really matter unless it takes on the dairy.
And when was the oven last used?
2019.
The problem is that it will absorb... And the oven's clean. If the oven's clean, yeah. And as long as you can eat it for dessert and not with the meal.
You haven't used it as God knows how long.
Right.
And you're maybe too fishy, like your vegetables or your whatever you're using off the
oven. It depends if it's going to make steam, because that would be the equivalent of making your vegetables in a daily pot. Even there, yeah. Because that's like using a clean dairy pot that hasn't been used in forever to make vegetables you're going to serve with your meat. You can't do that. The oven is like your pot in that case.
But what do you figure out what's
how much? What produces steam? If you have a doubt, assume it does produce steam. Only if you know it doesn't. And I know the post can talk about challah as not producing
steam.
So you
can steam. Make
steam. Pesach tshuva. I think the Pesach tshuva says...
You can make challah or cookie, something more solid, in a fleshed oven and then put butter on it.
Something that doesn't produce steam.
Yeah, like challah.
Yes. Challah is more complicated in terms of making, you said French toast?
Or cream cheese. Right.
It's more, it depends. Did you cut up the challah at a fleshed meal?
Yes.
It was a separate cut.
Yes. Yeah, then you'd be allowed to. Any other questions about the oven? Yes. No, burnt. It means clean, that there's nothing edible in it that could produce enough steam that would be... Yeah, if you have a discoloration in the oven, that's okay.
Well, what if like something spilled and it's just burnt?
You should try to clean it. But if it's... Because you don't know if that burnt thing is going to produce steam of the corned beef sauce from last week. It's totally burnt out, solid, not producing any steam, then it would be okay, but they're kind of iffy. Spray a little detergent on it. Oh, that's a separate issue, so I guess we'll talk about it for 1 second. Maybe we'll end with this. What if you have leftover challah? So this is, we covered the oven. Any other questions about the oven, how to use an oven? If you have one oven for meat and dairy? Okay. The question was,
Wait, talk about the fish and meat.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. I'll come back to it. The question was if you have cut up challah. So the halacha is that bread, which was present at one meal, a meat meal, should not be used at a dairy meal. Why? Because bread is considered a staple at meals, and it's sitting there in the middle of the table in your challah tray, your challah basket, your bread basket, and everyone's passing the food, and the corned beef dripping in the thing, and then someone dipped it in that, put it back in the challah thing, and the, so we don't use bread. Now, we assume that that only applies to bread that was cut, the part of the challah that was cut. So if you had cut challah at any of your Shabbos meals, you should not use it. Which is why, only cut the part of the challah you're confident you're going to eat, put aside the rest until you know you need it, because...
Does it make you flesh, or just don't eat it with dairy?
Don't use it for dairy. It doesn't make you fleshy. So you don't have to assume fleshy fell on it to the point that it makes you fleshy, but you should not use it to make French toast with milk or anything like that.
So like if like half a challah is left over.
Half a challah is left. You can cut it and use it Sunday morning.
And then
exactly.
You should take it off the table. You shouldn't leave it on the table.
Yeah,
you should take it away, and if you need it, bring it back.
Put it on the side. It shouldn't be. Shouldn't be the centerpiece.
Off of the
holiday,
just a little piece.
No. Then it's still okay. It's still okay. I'll tell you one last good one for you. I'll send you home with this. There's no problem buying cut up fruit. It doesn't need to be. You don't need a hechsher and cut up fruit.
Really?
Yeah.
Even pineapple?
Yeah. I want you to know when I was learning Yerodea, I came here. I was in the Kollel right after learning Yerodea. And I remember I had all these shilas about it. How is it possible? How can you? And I was talking to Rabbi Rabinovicki about it. And he was telling me, it's no problem. I was like, what do you mean? How could it be? And then he showed he was eating a thing of fruit that he bought at Publix. And so he's a pretty religious guy. So why is that? Because what's the problem with fruit? The fruit we know is inherently kosher. What's the issue? You're worried that you're going to use a knife to cut up. So the Shulchan Aruch already addresses this in Yerodea. And the Shulchan Aruch says, you have the right to assume that the first piece of fruit that was cut up with the knife, even if it was dirty, got whatever was on the dirt off, on the knife off. And you can assume that you didn't get that piece of fruit. So, vegetables that don't need inspection, yes. Not onions.
Unless they're pineapple? I thought pineapple.
Not onions. Pineapples are not considered davar charif, not a problem.
With strawberries,
though. I'm not talking about toloim. I'm not talking about checking for insects. So strawberries and raspberries, and if you're talking about vegetables, if you're talking about lettuce, that's a separate issue. When it's cut up, you can't assume it was checked, and you have problems. But if you're buying cut up red peppers, if you find yourself in a circumstance where you're in a business meeting, for example, right? I get questions all the time from people in business meetings. They can order in a restaurant if they have to, or at a hotel for breakfast or whatever, a plate of cut up red pepper, green pepper, carrots, celery, and so on. Tomatoes, cucumbers. You could order a plate of, right? And people mistakenly think they have to get, please bring me unpeeled whole fruit, which is not for a business meeting, you know. Right. You could get a plate of cut up fruit. Yeah. So right. So Shulchan Aruch says even if they did, let's assume the knife is dripping with chazer shmaltz. The knife is dripping with pig fat. It's a beferish halach in Shulchan Aruch that you have a right to assume that knife then cut up a watermelon that the chazer shmaltz came off on the first piece of watermelon that it cut and you didn't get that piece. And then I learned that Shulchan Aruch and I thought that's nice in theory. And then I spoke to Rabbi Rabinovicki, and he says, Lamaisa, every time he's here, he shops and he buys cut up fruit and vegetables. Yeah, in the supermarket, there's the added benefit of you're fairly confident. Although people who work in supermarkets will tell you that you don't know what's going on back there in the kitchen.
They tell you they use the knife.
You can see everything.
Correct. Right. Right. Yes. Yeah. Did he say the same thing?
Yes.
Oh, Baruch Hashem. Oh, she did. Right, so if your car breaks down and you're at some diner off the highway with one knife and one gross chef in the back, maybe be more careful. But Publix and Winn-Dixie. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. The hechsher allows them to up the price a little bit, but it's not necessary. Pineapples, yeah, it's not davar charif. Pineapples are crazy.